My guest today is David Ditchfield. In 2006, David was a functional alcoholic who had just been evicted from his flat and was living with his sister and her husband when he got his coat caught in the doors of a train, got dragged along by the train, thrown under the train, was severely injured, and as he was getting ready for surgery in the hospital, he had a profound near-death experience in which he was met by beings of light who were healing him in various ways. And we'll be getting into his story in great detail in this interview. In essence, when he recuperated a bit, he began to have impulses to paint paintings and eventually write music. And he ended up painting a lot of paintings, which we'll be showing in this interview, and also writing a couple of symphonies and a rhapsody. And he continues to do that stuff to this day. And needless to say, he's not an alcoholic anymore. Welcome to Buddha at the Gas Pump. My name is Rick Archer. Buddha at the Gas Pump is an ongoing series of interviews with spiritually awakening people. We've done well over 700 of them now. And if this is new to you and you'd like to check out previous ones, please go to batgap.com and look under the interviews menu where you'll see them all organized in various ways. This program is made possible through the support of appreciative listeners and viewers. So if you appreciate it and would like to help support it, there are PayPal buttons on every page of the website and also a page describing alternatives to PayPal. If you like this video or interview as you're watching it, please hit the like button. That helps the algorithm bring it to the attention of more people. And please hit the subscribe button if you feel inclined to do so. So let me read a bit more of an elaborate bio here of David. David is now an artist, composer, and author. In 2006, he had a horrific train accident in Cambridge, England, where he was pulled under the wheels of a speeding train. He's going to describe that to us in detail. This terrible accident nearly claimed his life, but moments before critical surgery, he had a profound spiritual experience filled with love, radiant light, and spiritual beings. This near-death experience, NDE as they're called, awakened hidden talents for music and painting. His musical journey is remarkable. Despite no formal training in classical music and an inability to read or write musical notation to this day, he has composed two symphonies and a rhapsody, all premiering at sold-out concerts. This included being commissioned by the Cambridge Clarinet Choir to write a piece based on his spiritual awakening. He continues to create classical works, currently working on a new symphony. His artistic endeavors are no less remarkable, with one of his inspirational NDE paintings recently on display as part of a year-long exhibition in the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. A few months ago, his extraordinary story reached a global audience when the BBC World Service aired a documentary about his journey titled My Journey Beyond Death. David's journey symbolizes the resilience of the human spirit and the boundless potential within all of us. He continues to paint and compose in Cambridge, England. I totally enjoyed your book. I converted it to audio and listened to the whole thing. But one interesting note that perhaps will get you started is that you were kind of scraping along and life was tough and, you know, you were drinking a lot of your scarce money and, yes. You know, not finding much work and had some classy girlfriend who was living in a different social strata than you were and life was difficult. Yeah. And on a whim, you met some lady on a train who said she was going to a spiritualist meeting to see a medium speak. And on a whim, you went to that and the medium picked you out of the audience and said, you're going to undergo a big change, buddy. But she wasn't getting any information on what it might be exactly. And you thought it might have something to do with your girlfriend or whatever. But it turned out it was getting dragged under a train.
Yeah. Which I did not see coming at all. I mean,
no,
my life at that point was, it was all kind of like, it was, I wouldn't say hedonistic, but it just wasn't grounded at all. You know, my life started out schooling. I struggled at school because I'm dyslexic and I wasn't diagnosed at the time. So I left school with no actual academic qualifications. So that was obviously a struggle for me. And, you know, that was like my blueprint, if you like. I just kind of, I was kind of seen as being a troublesome sort of pupil and, you know, one who's lazy and inattentive, all those kind of reports, you know, a lot of kids get who are struggling, which I didn't like because I actually did want to try and succeed. I wanted to do something, you know, but that wasn't happening. So when I left school, I thought, well, what am I going to do with my life? I thought, I'm going to move to London. I thought if I moved to London, you know, that would just be like, it was all going to open up for me. It was like the, you know, the land of hope and glory for me and stuff. And of course, that wasn't to be the case. You know, when I got there, I had a lot of high aspirations, hence the girlfriend that you talked about, the high maintenance girlfriend. You know, that's what I was aspiring to. That's what I thought I needed in my life, you know, and all these different things that I thought I needed were not really doing me any good. So to get by, because obviously like any capital city, it's very expensive to live and London's no different. I was just picking up day-to-day casual work, manual labouring work, you know, working on construction sites, anything I could pick up. And a lot of that work was really picked up by going down to the local pubs, the local bars from where I lived. And that's where all the site managers hung out after a day's work. And you just kind of hustle for work the next day. And of course, I'd end up just drinking my wages each night. So that's how that progressed into becoming an issue with me with alcoholism.
And then you were at some bar with your buddies, and there was a really cute bartender girl working there named Anna in your book. And you ended up befriending Anna, and it turned into a sort of relationship, but you were having kind of troubles taking that leap. And I remember you were seeing Anna off at the train in Cambridge, I guess. And then you got your coat caught in the doors of the train.
That's right. That's what happened. Yeah. I was, as you pointed out, you know, earlier, I was evicted from my apartment where I was living in London because I'd run out of money by then. And my sister and her family lived in Cambridge, and she said, come and stay with us for a few weeks. So that's what I did. And when I was up there, I'd only just really met Anna, and we just kind of, we got this connection where we connected, you know, and she was different. She just seemed different. She kind of represented a sort of sense of wholeness as well about her that were not all the things that, you know, that I was used to aspiring to before that point, you know, but I liked it and I liked that fact, but it kind of scared me at the same time knowing that she got that within her. But we kept in touch and she said, oh, you know, I want to come up and see you. And I said, great. So she came up, and that's how that happened. She'd got to get back to London. So I took her down to the rail station to see her off. And, do you know what's really strange is that actual day that, I mean, I was completely non-spiritual then as well. You know, that didn't enter into my life, but that actual day, it felt like there was an odd sort of vibration in the air. I remember my sister's cat was in the sort of bedroom and did this really bizarre thing. He just scrambled up on top of this very high cabinet, which is almost near the ceiling. And, was up there. I thought, what are you doing up there? And he just kind of stared at me. And I said, what are you trying to say? You know, so anyhow,
that's interesting.
It is interesting. Yeah.
I mean, you know how they say animals can sometimes predict earthquakes and tidal waves and tsunamis and things like that. They all run for the highlands when a tsunami is coming. Exactly. So I think maybe that cat was picking up on something in your aura or whatever.
Oh, completely. I mean, you know, he was an amazing cat. You know, he lived up until only a few years ago. And it's so funny because my sister's family, every time he did something strange like that, they go, whoa, what's about to happen? So,
yeah. They could have used him to play the stock market or something.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But I've learned now that the animals are, they're really tuned in. I mean, I think a lot of that is to do with the fact that, you know, we've kind of like developed so much, you know, as a human race that we've kind of like forgotten how to communicate. Other than, you know, you and I are talking now or we're using all technology and stuff like that. Whereas animals still communicate through, you know, vibration and the telepathy and all those different things. And so, yeah.
You know, Rupert Sheldrake's book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I've not heard of that. No.
Yeah. Rupert is a scientist over there in the UK, and he did this whole carefully controlled study about dogs that know when their owners are coming home. And he kind of threw a lot of randomness into it, like changing the schedule and, you know, having the owner take a taxi so it wouldn't be the sound of the familiar car or whatever. But long before the owner was, or the owner's car was in earshot of the dog, it would run to the front door and just wait, you know. And then sometimes he'd have the owner change plans entirely and decide not to come home, and the dog would go back and sit on his bed, you know, okay, he's not coming home. But there's very strong evidence that the dog was kind of psychic and able to pick up on that stuff.
Exactly. That's it. So yeah, there we go. So we turned up at the station. Eventually, it was a very cold February day, very ice cold. And there wasn't a cloud in the sky, I remember. And the train pulled into the station, and I helped Anna onto the car with her bags and everything. And I gave her a hug and a kiss to say goodbye. And as I did that, we heard the buzzers going, the emergency buzzers for the doors to close. And so Anna said, come on, you've got to get off. I said, yeah, don't worry, I'm going. And I stepped back. And as I did, the bottom corner of my coat got trapped in those automatic closing doors.
And you had like a big wool coat on or something.
It was an old sheepskin coat that I'd been given, you know, that it was like I inherited it sort of thing. Yeah. You know? So it was a good quality one. So it's quite thick, and there was no way it was going to pull free. You know, it was just in there. It was trapped.
And you couldn't wriggle out of it. That's why I was wondering when I first heard the story. Why can you just like rip it open and wriggle out?
No, because of the type it was, with it being so old, that it didn't have any sort of like silky lining like we all have now in all our coats. You know, it was just literally like the kind of like the, if you like, the sort of the fur on the inside of the sleeves. Right. And I just could not get it off. And I knew I wouldn't be able to get it off. In fact, there was only one other person on that platform seeing off his partner, his girlfriend or whatever. And he shouted to me, he said, get your coat off, mate. Get your coat off. And I thought, there's no point, you know, it's not going to come off. So yeah.
Yeah. And so then the train starts moving, and the conductor couldn't see you. And
He
was pulled into the wrong spot or something.
That's it, because it was one of these stations where it's not manned by a guard, which I didn't realize. I mean, I started yelling out for help. I thought a guard would come running forward and stuff, and I thought that or the driver would hear me and look out of the window, but none of that happened. And as you say, quite rightly, he pulled just. It came in a bit proud of the monitor, so you couldn't see. And because it was such a bright, low sun, that also obscured the view on the monitor, so he couldn't see me at all. Mm. And, it's strange, because I remember when the engine started to rev, I thought, well, you know, at that moment, I thought, this is it. I'm going to die, because I thought I can't pull it free. And it's interesting because it's almost like time stretched for me as well, because I had time to actually think through how I was going to deal with this. I mean, obviously I was terrified, but there was a sense of calm as well. And I actually remember thinking to myself, I'd seen this news footage about 2 or 3 weeks earlier where a small child had been thrown from a burning apartment block, you know, from the third floor, and had survived without any injuries. And they put that down to the fact that infants don't tense up like we do as adults. So I thought, relax your body. So as the train started pulling out, it pulled out at great speed. You know, I felt every gear shift. You don't realize how fast these trains pull out of stations until that happens and you're attached to the outside. And I ran with it at first, and then I lost my footing, and I kind of hoped that, you know, the force of my body would pull it free, but that didn't happen. Then I got sucked between, you know, the platform edge and the speeding train itself.
Which was how wide? I mean, show with your hands how wide that was between the
train. It's like that. It was just insane, you know, because
it's a real narrow little thing.
It's a really, really narrow, because it took me a long time to be able to go back even to that station. You know, I had lots of therapy to help me get back there. But whenever I do get on a train now, that's the most terrifying part, you know, is just getting on and off and looking at that gap and thinking, wow, how did I squeeze?
I mean, the gap couldn't be too wide because people have to step from the platform to the train and not fall in the gap.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously there's a slight
there's
step
stairs,
as well.
Yeah.
There was a massive rail police inquiry, you know, because it was a big thing with it being a rail accident, and it took them a year to do the whole thing. I mean, I remember they because I was interviewed by them quite a lot, you know, the police, and then they said to me that they'd taken the whole carriage down to London and they'd stripped it right down to the doors, down to the last rivet, you know. And they actually said to me when they were concluding, they said, "We just don't get it. We've done all our maths, all our figures, and you should not have survived this. You know, you should be dead." You know, it's
the amazing thing was that you were pulled under the train, so you were actually under the train, and somehow or other, a wheel didn't run over you and cut you in half.
I know. That is insane as well.
Yeah, I mean, you must have just kind of swung in there and boom, and then the wheels went by after you had gotten under.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, can you believe that? You know, the timing of it all, but that's exactly what happened. I mean, because for me, when I went under, I was fully conscious and I put myself into this relaxed mode. In fact, my friend Anna, you know, she ran through the train and looked through the window, and she told me afterwards when I was in hospital, she said, "Look, sounds really strange," he said, "but when I saw you go under, it's like you went under so gracefully." And I explained why, you know. So that obviously helped as well. But when I did actually go in, it was just like, I remember it was just being, that was a strange moment as well, because that felt like something had shifted. I felt like suddenly the train had become this huge mechanical beast that was determined to take me, and I thought, no, you're not going to take me. And it was like being thrown into, you know, I guess into, you know, a huge washing machine at full spin, and I was just tossed around relentlessly.
And somehow, just at that point, your coat ripped or pulled free finally from the door, because otherwise you would have just been dragged along.
I heard the rip. And I remember thinking, and I remember still now, the visually, it almost looked like the actual, you know, the car of the train almost seemed to disappear into the sky, you know. Then suddenly I was in darkness, you know, and into that violence, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then you had to lie there for a while the train kept going over you. And I remember you saying you just had to, like, keep your head really low in case there was some little sharp thing poking down from the bottom of the train.
I know. Again, what was really strange was I thought, right, what would, you know, James Bond or Indiana Jones do now in those situations, you know, because I've seen all those movies where those kind of things happen. He said he'd keep his face right down in the gravel. So that's what he did. And I remember that horrible smell of the oily gravel and keeping my face down. But then the train moved on and it was just like, wow. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. So help came pretty quickly because people had seen this happen. And next thing you know, there were medics there and they were getting you onto a stretcher and into an ambulance and all that stuff. Yeah. And, you got to the hospital and your left arm was totally ripped open. So you could see the bones and the veins and the nerves and everything. And the bones were, some of them broken. And, like, you know, anatomy class.
It was a complete mess. And even that was strange because that was one of the first things that I saw when I laid on the track. Cause obviously, like, I wanted to check my wounds. And it was just, there was a part of me was almost like kind of like fascinated thinking, I remember saying, wow, that's me, the inside of my arm. Those are all I could see all the nerve endings and muscles and everything. And it was really strange to think, you just don't think about what's going on beneath your skin, do you ever? And so, so that was really strange seeing all that. But, I remember we got in the ambulance and, you know, and the doctor in the back said, "Look, you know, we've just come from a small hospital around the corner. That's why we're here so quick. But the one that's going to save your life is a 30-minute drive. Can you do that?" I said, "Yeah, let's go," you know. So we just kind of went down the highway at full pelt with the siren going, you know.
They must have put a tourniquet on or something so you wouldn't lose too much blood.
Yeah. I mean, I knew I was losing a lot of blood when we got into the hospital because it was really apparent, you know. I could hear, there was a whole team of medics waiting there, you know, when we got into the emergency department, and I could hear fear in their voices. I didn't know what they were saying, of course. It was all numbers and science and stuff, but I thought, this doesn't sound too good. What was really surreal was because the actual consultant who ended up taking charge of me, he was there. He kept me really calm, you know, and he said to me, "We're going to have to take you straight into a theater pretty soon." He said, "But," he said, your family are here. Would you like to see them before you go in?" I was going, "Really?" I said, "Well, yeah, sure." You know, so they came through, you know, and I remember my sister said afterwards, you know, she said there was just so much blood on the floor, you know. So that's how much I was losing at that point. So that's where it was getting a bit sort of why they wanted to get me in there pretty quick. Yeah.
Interesting. And so just as I guess it was just before you went into surgery, you had this NDE, right?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So let's spend plenty of time talking about that. I mean, you can spend all the time you want talking about, because that's a really central piece of the whole story.
Sure. Yeah. Well, basically, I left my body, you know, I left all the pain and the agony that I was in. I left the drama of the hospital and the bright fluorescent light, you know, that was like sort of shining in my eyes. And then suddenly I was transported, I guess is the one way to describe it, into what seemed to be like a small darkened space, a small darkened room. I figured at first, you know, and I thought, what's going on? Where am I? And I thought straight away, this is death. You know, I haven't made it. I didn't make it. I'm dead. and I wasn't, the strange thing is that I didn't resist it. I didn't fight it. You know, I didn't feel any sense of fear. I mean, I've since heard other people's accounts of near-death experiences, and some people do try to resist it at first because they've got young kids and stuff like that to they don't want to give all that up, you know. But for me, it's not like I wanted to die, but it was just, I thought I didn't have that sense of wanting to resist it. So I tried to get my bearings, you know, I kind of looked around me, you know, and, I was looked through this darkness, and then suddenly I was greeted by these pulsating colors of lights that were pulsating all around me slowly, you know. They were like sort of orbs of sort of yellows, you know, greens, ambers, golds, what have you, you know. They were lovely colors, but they were really mellow. And that made me feel safe. That made me feel that I was in a safe place. And if this was death, then it's not so bad, you know.
Yeah. And incidentally, you've painted pictures, paintings of some of these scenes. So as we're talking here, as you're speaking, if there's a particular photo that you've sent me that you'd like me to display, just let me know.
Yeah, sure. Will do. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Well, so as I laid out, I just thought I wanted to check, you know, my body, my wounds, and see how that was all looking. So I kind of sat up, and then I realized I was no longer laid out on the hospital trolley that I'd been on for so long there. And instead I was now on this kind of like huge slate rock, or like a granite rock. You know, I describe it as being like a medieval altar or something from Stonehenge or something like that, you know, and it felt surprisingly comfortable to be laid out on. And that was also considering the fact that I realized I was no longer clothed. You know, I was just covered in this blue satin sort of silky textured material that felt like almost like a comfort blanket. And all my wounds were completely fine. There wasn't even a single scratch or scar, you know, my body was back intact. So that made me also feel reassured and good about things. So I decided to lay back on this granite rock and close my eyes for a while. And as I closed my eyes, I suddenly started to see light coming through my eyelids. And so I opened my eyes, and above me were like these three symmetrical grids of white light, pure bright white light that was slowly closing in towards me from above. And I couldn't take my gaze away from this light, even though it was like so bright. Normally that kind of light would be too intense to look at in this realm. But there it was totally fine. And the reason I couldn't stop looking at it, because I knew there was like a healing force, a healing energy coming from that light that was healing all the trauma that I'd just been through, both physically, you know, and emotionally, but mainly physically. I felt like, you know, that light was just kind of like bathing me in this kind of energy of healing. So I closed my eyes and I trusted in this completely, and I just laid there, and then as this went on, I suddenly felt the presence of somebody. I felt like somebody had walked into this small darkened room, and so I lifted my head and opened my eyes, and I can now I suggest one of the paintings, actually, which is called Greeting by the Being of Light.
Yep, I will show that.
So, just ahead of my feet was this androgynous being that you can see in that painting there, wearing a very simple contemporary black T-shirt. Nothing too ethereal, as I figured I might be seeing, you know, but just a simple black T-shirt with this pure white blonde hair and this skin that was sort of emanating light from within. And this person was just gazing at me and smiling, you know. And I said out loud, I said, I know your face. Who are you? I just couldn't place it. It's like I knew this person so well, but I didn't know where from. And this person just kept looking back at me and smiling and saying nothing, but with a reassuring smile. So I just figured, okay, that's okay. Then I started to realize that information was slowly coming through, almost in a form of telepathy, I guess, if you like. You know, going back to that thing talking about animals, you know, that I started to get, you know, information that this person was the gatekeeper to wherever I was right now, that this person was there to guard me, my higher self, if you like. You know, that's probably why I felt that sense of knowing.
Higher self, guardian angel, maybe.
Exactly, that's it. Yeah. But, you know, people have different phrases. So, yeah, all those different things that we talk about, you know, when people talk about praying and, you know, and saying, oh, you know, they pray to their guardian angels and so, that's what my guardian angel appeared as being and was there to kind of reassure me and to guide me through, you know, where I was about to go on this journey. So I closed my eyes and laid back. And then I suddenly started to feel the presence of more people, if you like, you know, around me, as you do, you know, if you're taking an afternoon nap, you know, somebody walks in the room, you know, someone's there, don't you? And that's what happened. So I opened my eyes and either side of me were two female forms this time. There was a girl to my right, and she was like had dark skin, but was quite European looking, with a very simple brown dress on. And whereas the girl to my left was more American Indian, Asian Indian, maybe South American, I don't know. But she was wearing this beautiful, ornate sort of traditional dress. But they had their hands slowly hovering over the contours of my body without actually touching me. And their hands were just smoothly going over every single part of my body. And that felt great. I suddenly started to feel this kind of this energy of love that was coming from their hands. And I realized that they were going beyond just healing the physical wounds. They were healing, like, you know, all the emotional scars that I carried over the years, you know, that we all carry, you know, the peeling off the layers of baggage. You know, we use that phrase in the UK. I don't know if you do, but, you know, that's like, say, oh, that person's carrying a lot of baggage, you know.
Sure.
And I certainly had been carrying a lot of baggage. So all those layers of baggage were slowly being taken off bit by bit, and they were just getting right down to the pure essence of my soul, you know, and that was incredibly liberating and incredibly beautiful and calm. I lay there, and this healing was just so deep that I didn't want it to stop, and it continued. But then I started to think about my family. I started to wonder how they were, because I thought, well, clearly I must be dead. That means that I'd seen how distraught they'd all been. You know, my mother had been in tears. And I thought, they're going to be really upset now. So I wanted to check on them. So I thought I'd hoist myself over the edge of this huge granite rock and see if I could see them. And I thought I'd look down. And I did look down, but when I did look down, I couldn't see them at all. But what I saw was just what it made up for it, really, because it was just this beautiful sight. It was like it was a huge waterfall of stars. Let's say it's the size of Niagara or Victoria Falls. You know, it was really vast. It was very huge. And I suddenly realized at this point that I'm no longer in this small, darkened space that I thought I was in. I'm actually in the universe itself, you know, and I'm witnessing, instead of billions of tons of water toppling over the edge, I'm seeing billions of beautiful stars that were cascading over, shooting stars flying all over the place. And I was looking down, I was going, wow, you know, it was just, I remember my eyes were fixing, and I felt like I was looking down into infinity from one galaxy into another. And I was seeing colors formed, you know, all again, all these different kind of colors I'd seen in the orbs. But this time they were nebulous, and which was totally unfamiliar to me because I got no interest in astronomy at all in my life at that point. You know, to me, the universe was just like, you know, the black sky at night with the white stars. You know, that's, I didn't realize there were colors and gases, but that's what I was looking at. So I was, and I felt the sense of being moved and carried by the energy, forward motion of the universe. So that was really, really strong. That was a really powerful thing to be feeling this, you know. And the interesting thing is that I thought, okay, well, I can't see my family, but that's okay. That me before, I would have been feeling traumatized. I would have been feeling guilt and shame and, oh no, I can't see them. But all those kind of emotions were dispersed and I felt none of that at all, you know. I remember just thinking, well, you know, I can't see them, but I'm sure I'm going to see them at some point soon. And if I don't, they're going to be enjoying all these wonders and all these delights that I'm now looking at and feeling and going through. So yeah, so I pulled myself back over onto the rock and laid there, and I closed my eyes and continued to bathe in all this beautiful healing energy that was surrounding me. And then it as time went on, although time didn't exist actually, but you know, just to take you through it, just the most incredible part was to really come at the end of this experience. And this was I laid there, I suddenly felt this energy of unconditional love that was coming from the hands of the healers was now intensified. I felt like every single molecule of my body was starting to vibrate with this energy of love. And I thought, what's going on? You know, this really made me look up quick, you know. So I just kind of got up and looked. And just beyond the being of light that was still stood at my feet was this a tunnel of white light that was coming through the universe, coming through. And it was surrounded by all these powerful flames. It was like pure white light. But the powerful flames that were surrounding it, as you can see there, were so strong and huge that normally I would be kind of overwhelmed with fear and terror, thinking, what is going on now? Where am I being taken? But I wasn't at all. I was there was a sensation of, like, again, complete trust in this, that this was all good, you know, because the vibration that was coming from that light was just so awe-inspiring. It was just like a sort of, like, it was just filling every single part of me with this sensation of love and feeling liberated. It was just so strong, you know, that, and I'd never felt that in my life before. You know, I'd felt no self-love, you know, no self-worth, you know, and it was just like all that came together at that point. And then I started to get more information coming through. And what I was being told was that what I was looking at here and what I was feeling as this light was getting closer to me and the vibration started to get more intense was that what I was looking here was the source of all creation. You know, God, if you like. This was like God, not in the form of what I'd been used to seeing in my textbooks at school, you know, the Michelangelo guy with a long beard or whatever faith you may have. You know, there's normally some kind of human form attached to God, but no, this was God in this beautiful white tunnel of light, which again, I think I did another painting now, which is called the Moment of Realization. So that's literally sort of emphasizing that actual moment where I thought to myself, yeah, this is it. This is God. This is God. This is the absolute unconditional love coming from this point. So that's what I was trying to sort of really paint myself, just hoisting myself up from the rock covered in the blue satin sheet, as you can see there, just kind of like reaching out to this point of trust and knowing that this was the source of all creation. This was the source of all light and goodness. And it was at that point that I just, I remember laughing out loud to myself in absolute joy, you know, and I kind of like almost like threw myself back down, you know, onto the rock. And then I suddenly left this whole experience and came crashing back into my body. You know, I was just like back in the hospital and all the beautiful warmth and love that I'd been experiencing out there was now replaced with all the pain and the agony came rushing straight back through my body. And that beautiful light was now replaced by the fluorescent strip. And I remember the noise of the sound of the hospital was like this kind of almost like this overkill of shrill, you know, in my ears. It was like, whoa, you know, I wanted to cover my ears. And, there I was back in my body. But still almost attached to that realm. You know, a lot of people say to me, you must have been instantly gutted, you know, upset that you come back, you know, and it was all over for you, that experience. And I said, not at all, because I felt like I was like still attached, like almost like an umbilical cord of all that wonderful energy was still coming right through me, you know. So, yeah. So there I was.
Good. So was that basically the end of the NDE, and then you're back in the hospital?
So I'm back in the hospital. That's it. Yeah. And then, you know, it was at that point that I remember, you know, the consultant saying, we're going to take you through now, David. And then I saw my friend Anna, you know, sat at the back of the emergency department. I said, hang on. I want to speak to Anna, because I wanted to check she was okay. Cause I knew that she'd been through all this with me, you know, the whole accident itself, you know. And so she came forward, you know, and I said, are you okay, you know? And she was just shaking her head from side to side. She said, I thought you were dead. They announced over the speakers at the rail station, the next station that they took her to, that you were dead, you know. And so
really, they announced it that you were dead at the next station.
They said there'd been a fatality. They said trains are delayed because there's been a fatality at the previous station in Cambridge. So obviously that's what she assumed that had happened. And she figured it as well when she saw me go under. What's amazing is because I remember she told me that you know, because the train. She ran through the train trying to find a guard to stop the train as well, you know, and because there was all these levers and all these different things. And there was all these different signs saying, if you pull this, you'll be fined. If you pull that, don't pull this, don't pull that. And obviously, if you're in a state of shock, you can't take all that in. So she ran through the train, and then she finally found, you know, a guard on the train, and then they stopped it in the middle of the countryside. And she said to me, she said that when that train stopped, she turned around to everyone on the carriage and said, look, my friend's just gone under the train. That's why we stopped. And could we say a prayer for him? You know, she said it was amazing. She said, this woman stepped forward and said, look, I'm a Christian. Would you like me to take the prayers for you? And she said, yes, that'd be great. So she said, this woman started praying, and she said, everyone just laid down their newspaper, because they're all commuters, you know, so they laid down their laptops and what have you, and newspapers, and everyone prayed. And that was quite a special moment, because I remember feeling people's prayers. I remember feeling the energy of prayers. I really believe in that energy of prayer now, because I felt it, you know, when it was coming through. So there I was back in the hospital, and then I was wheeled through into theatre, and I was under for about 8.5 hours, I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah. So some people might be thinking, okay, you must have had this NDE when you were given anesthesia, but no, you hadn't had the anesthesia yet. You were just still lying there on a gurney, waiting to, you know, while they got ready to operate on you.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. I mean, when I started writing my book, putting that together, you know, I got a friend she was a nurse, and then she'd moved on from that. She was lecturing in nursing, so I said to her, look, I said, I'm putting this book together, and I said, I wonder if I'd like to get some medical records. She said, well, you can just write to the hospital and you can access them, and you pay for them, but you'll get the whole lot. I said, great, I'll do that. So I got them all, and then I asked her to read through it, because I wanted to cover all that as well, you know, because obviously I realized that understandably that people will have those thoughts there, that, you know, that, all these things could be brought on by, you know, sort of
drugs,
chemical things and drugs and stuff like that. So yeah. And, she got back to me and I said, be honest as well, please don't, you know, and so she said, yeah, you would have been under nothing at all at the point that you actually had your near-death experience that would have altered what's happening with your mind and stuff. But, and I mean, the other thing is as well is, it's just that it's not like a dream state, and it's not like a hallucinative state either, you know, because dreams and hallucinative states, they're kind of chaotic and they change as well, you know, the structure as you tell them over the years, they change. But for me, that's never changed, you know, at all. The whole thing was like, I describe it as being ultra real, you know, it was just like incredibly.
A very lucid experience. You were not just in some dopey, dreamy state.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. It's funny. I mean, you hear this with all the NDE experiences, people trying to rationalize and excuse them and because it threatens their paradigm. You know, I mean, you know, the predominant paradigm is when your body dies, that's curtains, you know, you're dead, you don't exist anymore. And, when people come back with these stories that contradict that paradigm, it makes the paradigm holders uncomfortable, and they try to come up with reasons why, you know, it wasn't a real experience. It was some kind of hallucination, you know, brain was starved of oxygen, or you were influenced by drugs and all that stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, I've done a few debates and stuff like that, you know, on the radio, on the BBC and stuff like that, and where they've had scientists on, and they've contacted me and they said, look, we've got a scientist who's doing studies into NDEs. Would you like to come on and talk? I said, yeah, totally. So, you know, for me, science also saved me. Yeah, I mean, without science, I wouldn't be talking to you now as well. You know, the scientists, I totally respect. But I also, one thing I was saying that is that we do, it's almost like we all need to have a scientific explanation for everything, which is kind of insane, because we can't, you know. I started watching programs ever since that experience on the universe. Now I love watching programs about the universe, so they're science based. And there was one guy I love called Professor Brian Cox, who's a UK guy.
Oh yeah, I'm aware of him.
Yeah, and he's great. And so there was a program I saw only a couple of years back, and he was saying that, he said that everyone thinks that as scientists we've got all the answers to the universe. He said, but we haven't. He said, we're only at the beginning of trying to understand the vastness of it all. We, you know, they're really, really only just touching the surface of trying to understand all that. So I thought that's great that he said that, because it's absolutely true, you know. I mean, there's other things in life that we don't question. There's no scientific equation for people falling in love, you know, for love, what makes us fall in love and all those different things. There's no
some scientists would say, oh yes, it's hormones, it's, you know, it's biological instinct, it's DNA, you know, they'd come up with reasons.
Yeah, no, of course, yeah. But again, I would argue that they're probably only touching the surface. So they're not, there's no sort of like, okay, because otherwise you'd have that in a bottle, wouldn't you? <It's> like,
there was a song about that. It was called Love Potion Number 9 back in the 60s.
Okay, well, there you go. So scientists would be saying, yeah, great. This is going to be the biggest selling drug of all time, isn't it? You know? Love Potion Number 9.
I'll spare you the torment of hearing me sing it, and my wife's torment if I were to sing it. But but it's funny, because on the one hand, yes, many scientists, perhaps all, if you really pinned them down, would acknowledge that, yeah, you know, there's so much we don't know, and you know, we're just scratching the surface. We've just begun basically to understand the universe. On the other hand, maybe sometimes even the same people dig their heels in and say, nope, there couldn't be God. There couldn't be this, you know, other side. And, you know, when you're dead, you're dead. And it's kind of paradoxical that they could, you know, have a foot in both camps like that.
Yeah, well, that's true, isn't it? Because, you know, Brian Cox, he's, he doesn't believe there's a God. He doesn't believe in that. So which is interesting. But that's fine, you know. I mean, everyone's, you know, we've got a broad spectrum of things that we can believe in. But I just feel that ultimately it's great to have a faith, you know, some kind of faith, because, you know, it's like, you know, sometimes I might read online, you know, sometimes just a flippant comment that somebody I don't even know might just turn around and say, you know, whenever I read things like people saying, you know, you got to live life to the full now because you only get one life. Enjoy it while you can because, you know, it's lights out soon and all that kind of thing. I think, wow, how could you possibly enjoy living your life like that? You know, it's just like without having some kind of faith that maybe this isn't the only journey that we're on, you know, that the journey continues, you know, for me, it's certainly altered my mind state, you know, not just for myself, but for loved ones. You know, I lost both my parents, over the past, 5 years, and it helped me greatly to, you know, be able to cope with the loss. Obviously, I grieved the loss of them being with me and the love and things like that. But it really helped me to know that you know, this wasn't the end of the story. And, when my mum passed, you know, I remember going into the hospital because she'd had a minor heart attack. So my sister and I were in the hospital the night before she passed. It was interesting because she had Alzheimer's, and that particular night, we both said afterwards, it was almost like the Alzheimer's wasn't there, you know, and we were communicating, and all we did was just exchange how much we loved each other, you know, which is great. And then, I got a call the next morning from the hospital and I thought, oh, this is not good. You know, it was about 7:30 a.m. And it was the doctor saying, you better come in. Your mum's just had a massive heart attack. And I just thought, this is it, you know. And so, but I remember going in and they said, oh, do you want to, for all of us to go in and say our farewells to my mum, you know, who's behind the curtain in the hospital ward and stuff, you know. So, and I remember turning around and I said to my mum, well, mum, you're going to enjoy where you're going now. You're going to love it. It's going to be great, you know. And that's how I felt, you know, rather than feeling, no, you know, so that was really lovely.
Yeah. There used to be a beer commercial, which was something like, you only go around once in this life, so grab all the gusto you can get.
Exactly. That's it. Yeah. That's the kind of thing, isn't it? You just think, oh, man, that's not a way to live at all, isn't it? It's basically like going through life in first gear, you know.
Yeah. It's very discouraging because obviously as you get older, you begin to lose your ability to enjoy all these things that, you know, defined your life. And so, you know, it just gets more and more depressing. But if you realize, as you've just been describing, that, you know, death is not an end. It's an end to a chapter in a very big book.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's just, you know, whatever your faith is, you know. It's interesting, actually, because both my parents were Christian, and I talked to them. I said, you know, does it ever get discussed, the afterlife, you know, about what happens to us all afterwards? And they said, no, it's just like only with Christ. You know, Christ was the only person they talk about who, you know, came back, who rose from the dead, and that's it. And I found that kind of like, I thought, wow, that's strange. I thought, you know, the fact that, you know, that there's a faith there. I always thought that it would be interesting to explore that at least, you know, which it was. Yeah.
Well, of course they have beliefs, you know, like either you're going to hell for eternity or you're going to heaven for eternity and all this. I was listening to a podcast the other day, called Closer to Truth, which is one of my favorite podcasts. And the guy was interviewing these people from different religions about their beliefs of the afterlife. And he was interviewing this Muslim guy, and he was going to this elaborate description of all the different things that are supposed to happen and, you know, where you go and what happens to your body and all kinds of stuff, which seemed to me to be extremely speculative. And at the end, the interviewer said, well, this is amazing what the human mind can conjure up. And the guy said, no, we believe this. This is the truth. But then he went on to interview a whole bunch of other people who had different truths. You know, belief doesn't really cut it. But you and people like you have had experience, which makes it more than a belief.
Yeah. I hope so. You know, I hope it does, you know, encourage people, because I mean, because for me, that's, you know, that's where it's at. It's not like me trying to say, hey, I had this amazing experience. You got to hear it. You know, it's more like if I can at least help somebody get past that fear of death. And for example, you know, there was, you know, I didn't realize how so many people do have a fear of death, you know, young people as well. A lot of people suppress it as well, though, in all fairness. Yeah. I think a lot of people don't even want to think about death. They don't want to think about what's happening afterwards, you know. And I can see, I've seen that untangle in people when they've lost their loved ones, because there's, you know, they're fearing that they don't know what's going to happen to them now. Is that it? You know, are they going to end up, you know, just floating around in some void, or, you know, all those different things that might be going through their minds, you know, rather than really exploring it. And I just feel that we just don't do that in Western civilization anyway. We don't explore death. And I think that it's not like we should be getting up talking about it every day after our morning coffee, but I think it's good to at least embrace it and talk about it like we are now, you know, and talk about death, you know, because it absolutely helps. Because we prepare for everything else in life. We prepare for birth, marriage, even taking our driving lessons and passing our test, all those different things. But we don't prepare for the one thing that's going to come to us all, which is the end of this stage of the journey.
You know that Buddhist saying, die before you die. And, you know, what they're saying actually, and Hindus have similar comments, is that through certain spiritual practices, you can transcend your individuality, which is a kind of a mini death. Obviously, your body is not in any danger, but you get to peep into the universal ground of existence, and, which is what someone might experience when they physically die. But then you come back to life, and you can integrate that experience so that you're kind of in a liberated state, a state of freedom in the midst of living a normal life in the world.
Absolutely. Well, that's it. You know, it can change your mindset. If you've got this heavy weight that you're denying, you know, which is like what's going to happen not only to me, but to my loved ones, you know, if you can help to release that, I think it changes like your whole outlook on life. It has done with me, because I certainly didn't even think about it. You know, death didn't even come into my equation. All I was thinking of was like, you know, Where's the next paycheck coming from? You know, where's the next, you know, great relationship going to come from? And all these different things are all very linear. My life was linear before, you know, so there was no sort of light, sort of, you know, sort of
deeper peaks
and troughs or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's shift into the whole discussion about your art and your music and that kind of thing. And incidentally, another point to mention here is that at the end of this interview we'll be playing a section of one of David's symphonies, and while that's playing we'll show a number of his paintings, including some that we haven't shown so far in this video. So when did you first feel an impulse to paint something?
It was pretty much as soon as I came around from the anesthetic. The hospital had given me my own room, because of the severity of the accident and stuff. And I remember I was laid there, it was like about 2 a.m. or what have you. And I was just kind of like in this small darkened room, but now it was the hospital room. And I just got this little R2-D2 machine bleeping next to me. And I thought, I was just kind of like processing what had happened with the accident. You know, going under a train is a huge thing, but also, I was more fixated on this whole experience that I'd had, the spiritual experience, you know, the near-death experience itself, which I didn't know anything about near-death experiences. So I didn't know what had happened. And I thought, is it just me that this has happened to. And I thought, this is far too important to not be able to share this. So I knew.
Did you start telling nurses and people about it?
Yeah, yeah. Not nurses straight away. No, I wanted to tell my loved ones to start off with, because, you know, I wanted to honor them with that. But I took my time, you know, it took me a while to tell my parents because, as I said, with them being Christians, I wanted them to get it, and I thought they might not get it because it might sort of jar with their faith. But they did. They got it. In fact, what was really strange was when I did tell my parents that they listened, and then they looked, and then they turned around, and my mum said, "We knew." And I said, "You knew? How did you? What do you mean you knew, Mum?" And she said, well, you know, it's just you're we come into this hospital, we walk into this room, you're surrounded by the nurses and you've got all these tubes and wires coming out of you. She said, but you're just kind of glowing and you're just kind of like giving out to others, whereas they're supposed to be giving to you. And they saw this shift in me, which is obviously a massive shift, because they understood how I was struggling, you know, with my life before that point, you know, what a dark place I was in. So for them, maybe their faith helped them understand it. But, going back to the idea of the painting was I initially thought, I can't afford to forget all this. You know, I might forget it and I want to make sure that I remember everything. And I thought, I'm going to do a painting. I'm going to do something like I'd never done anything like this before. I wanted to do something like really huge, like a big, like all these sort of Renaissance paintings, you know, those very dramatic scenes of the Bible that you see, you know, that Michelangelo did and Raphael and stuff like that. And I wanted to get something like that. And it had to be big to get the story across dramatically enough that it warranted. And so I remember my sister coming in to visit me the first night, and she was chatting and she said very quietly as she was about to leave, she said, "Is there anything I can get you?" I said, "Yeah, can you get me like a small sketch pad and a pencil?" And she was going, "Really?" I said, "Yeah, really." And so she said, "Okay." So she brought that in, and the nurses propped me up in the bed, you know, and I managed to start sketching what I was going to do in the very first painting, which was trying to sort of get everything into one painting. I've still got that sketch, but I'm not even going to attempt to show it you now because it's just so faint because I'm so weak. But it was just the beginnings of what was going to be, you know, my very first painting. So when I got out of hospital, once I started getting physical strength up enough to be able to start painting, I got that canvas, and it was leaning against the wall for a long time because, you know, I was kind of like, didn't want to mess this up. I wanted to get this right. So I was kept putting it off. Some friends of my sister was around one day, and then they came in and they said, "Oh, you've still got that canvas against the wall then?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, I can't paint. I can't start in here. There's not enough light and stuff." And they said, "Well, that's no excuse, because they ran a health center and they said, we're closing for a week for refurbishment. So we've got a studio space going that you can use." So I said, "Great." So they took the canvas down there and I went in and I started painting. You know, I started the first bits bravely, putting the paint on that canvas. And it was amazing because it started to come together so well immediately. And I felt like I was being helped. I felt like this energy was still coming through again from that realm that was helping me to produce something that I'd never produced in my whole life, which was a painting. Yeah, been able to sort of like almost like get flesh tones and be brave with colors rather than just say, okay, this is, before I would have just said, right, this person's flesh is that color, do you just need one color? I thought, no, just throw in some greens and blues and, you know, throw them all in there. And it started to come alive. So I became, you know, I got towards the end of the week, and I said, "There's no way I'm going to get this finished." And they said, "That's fine." Then my sister's friend said, "We'll just move you around from studio to studio and you can stay here." You know, so that was great. And I ended up staying there for 2 years and they didn't charge me at all. So that was amazing. And I became known as the artist in the attic, you know, cause I was up in the lofts, you know, doing all this, putting these paintings together. So
did you take any art lessons during this time, or are you just
No, no, not at all. You know, the art lessons were coming from within. You know, I used to say I was channeling. I was channeling ideas through. But what I'm, you know, realizing now was basically it's more that I was allowing myself to go into a state of presence. Basically, I was completely present when I was doing all this artwork. And it was also helping me to heal from the accident as well. You know, it was a great healing power as well. So I took no lessons at all whatsoever, and I just improved with each painting that I did, and you know, became more and more brave. And
that's cool, because you mastered perspective, depth, you know, and anatomical proportions that are correct, and all that kind of stuff, which people study in art school to get the hang of.
I know, absolutely. That's it. That's what's remarkable. So it's just, you know, I mean, obviously I became more aware. I would study people myself. I would study how people held themselves. I would study the fact that, you know, not everyone has the same body language, that some people have this, that, and the other.
People would start to say to me, oh yeah, when you're painting people, that you're kind of like, it's almost like you're getting behind, you're bringing people alive. You're giving people a sense of presence. And I didn't even realize I was doing that. So it wasn't something I was conscious of, but that's probably why it was coming together for me. I was also encouraged as well by the fact that, these people who would come in for yoga and Pilates sessions were coming up. They all wanted to see how the paintings were coming on, you know, and so I'd get all that feedback from them. And not only that, people would ask me what the paintings were about. So that was my first sort of, you know, getting my feet to start telling other people that I didn't know.
Sure,
about
and those
kind
of people would be open to that kind of thing, you know.
Well, they were pretty cool, you know. It was kind
of yoga people. Yes. That experience, no problem.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Yeah, and I wanted to go back when I was getting well. I said to my sister, I want to try and find that spiritualist church that I went to where the medium was predicting what was going to happen to me, because I wanted to go back there. And I said, because at that point I didn't really realize what was going on, you know. And I went along, and I went to one of their meetings, you know, and they turned around and said, they told me you had a near death experience. I said, oh, okay, that's what it is, you know. And
then there was some woman that you started seeing regularly there who was a healer or something. Was that before or after your NDE? That was after.
No,
right?
That was after the NDE. Yeah. That was after my first visit to the church. We were sat having coffee afterwards, and we all sat around, and then the German lady came over to me called Maria, who's one of the spiritual healers at that church. And she said, oh, we don't normally invite people along. People come of their own accord, but you look, you know, pretty banged up. Yeah, I've got all this stuff holding me together, you know. And she said, we do spiritual healing. Would you be interested? I said, yeah, that sounds great. So I started going for spiritual healing, which was amazing, you know, because it just kind of like that not only helped me physically, but emotionally, you know, a lot.
Yeah.
So that was great. So that's how that came about.
So you're painting to this day and continue to paint. And then the music thing started. You started having themes of music in your head and had to figure out what to do with them.
That's right, yeah. And this sprung from, because some of the spiritual healers, yeah, you'd have two or three healers working on you, if you like, and some of them would be clairvoyant, and they'd just give a few little messages at the end. They'd say, oh, I saw like a blue light coming through your heart chakra or whatever, you know. And then I started to see this theme that was being repetitive. One of them would say, oh, you know, the German lady said, yeah, why am I seeing Beethoven, Wagner, and seeing another one said, I saw a violin laid across your chest. And then one of them turned around to me and said, oh, they're telling me, when they said they're telling me, either my guides or her guides are telling me that you're going to write a piece of music about your experience. I went, great. So I went home and I thought it was going to be a song. You know, I just got this old synthesizer at the loft or whatever, you know, and it was a beaten old thing. And then I borrowed a cassette recorder off my dad that he had in his garage, you know, and so that's all I had. And I started to try and write this song, and that wasn't coming together like the painting is. I thought, this isn't happening in the same way. And then one afternoon, I was just kind of like watching this old movie on the TV, and I was watching it, and I was just kind of playing around. I got this keyboard out, and then suddenly this little chord progression happened, and I thought, oh, I like that. That sounds really good. So I recorded it on the cassette, and I started to develop it. I thought, this is not meant to be a song. It's meant to be something played by an orchestra. Yeah. And so I thought, that's where I'm taking it. And I had that same sense of like, nothing was going to stop me. Just like the paintings, I thought, let's go, you know. So I started to develop that on this little cheap old synthesizer, you know. And one of the people who used to come in and have yoga sessions was, she played cello in the local orchestra, and we became friends. She was quite spiritual, and we used to go for coffee. So I started telling her about this piece of music, and she laughed and said, oh, maybe we could perform it, you know. And I thought, wow, yeah, why not? You know, that'd be great. So, so I I got in touch with my brother, and he said, look, you can't just like hand out cassettes to an orchestra and say, here's all the parts, you know.
And your brother was a member of that orchestra also playing French horn.
Yeah, not in that orchestra. No, he was playing French orchestra. He lived down in London. So he was down there. So he said, well, you'll need music score. And I said, well, I can't write music. I can't even read music. He said,
yeah, you're an old punk rocker, right? That was the extent of your musical experience.
All I could do was thrash out three chords just about on a guitar, you know? So he said to me, listen, I'm going to give you, you know, an old computer of mine. And he said, and then I'm going to give you this app. And he said, when you play the keyboard, I'm going to give you the keyboard I'm going to give you, that it will transpose those notes that you're playing into a musical format, you know. And so, and then he said, give it back to me and then I'll look through it, you know. And I said, great. And so we did that together, and then I printed off the parts and I told them, the orchestra, this is where I was at. And they said, well, let's meet for coffee. So I met up with my friend and also with the conductor and a few other people, and they looked at the score, and I was amazed because I thought they'd want to hear what I'd done, and they could tell just by reading music what it was going to sound like. I was shocked. I said, you don't even want to hear what I've done on the cassette. They said, no, we can get it from here. This is really good. So they said, we'll perform it. So I said, fantastic.
Yeah. That's great. It was quite a story, actually, because I think they only practiced it once before the performance, or maybe twice, I don't know, but they were so good that they could just do that. They were all professional level musicians. And then you had this debut performance of your symphony, which was three movements by that time, a full symphony. You had to write the lines of music for each separate thing, right? For the strings, for the horns, percussion, everything.
You know, I started to realize, just like with the paintings, that there was more textures than just violins. I used to think classical music was just violins. And I started to realize, no, there's more instruments that I can use. And in fact, it was my brother said that. I said, why don't you start using, he said, you've just got strings, you've got cellos and violins, you start using other stuff. And I was going, like, what? And he said, well, you know, like French horn for starters. I was going, I've already got French horn in there, I said, because you play it. And then I started throwing in other instruments. And then I started to realize it was giving this piece of music more dimension, more color, you know, and it was starting to come alive even more. The only reason I could do this was because the synthesizer had like very cheap synthetic sounds of a trumpet or what have you, you know, so I could pretty much roughly hear how that was going to come together. But the rehearsal itself, that was mind blowing, you know, because I turned up to the first rehearsal and I was incredibly nervous because I thought, is this just going to like come tumbling down, you know, like a block of bricks, or is it going to come together? So I had faith, but at the same time, I was nervous because I knew nothing about all this. And I walked in, and also the orchestra, you know, they were lovely people, but it's quite a sort of foreboding setup. You know, they don't really give much away, classical musicians. So they don't turn around and say, this is great. You know, so I didn't know what to think. So I walked in and the conductor said, oh, the composer's here. And I was going, no, it's me. I'm not the composer. And he said, David, would you like to come forward and say a few words? And I said, no, it's fine. You just go ahead. He said, come on. So I stepped up and I started telling them what it was about. I talked about the near-death experience and people were asking me loads of questions. I thought, this is great. People were really keen to know what it was about. And that helped me to have faith. And so I went and sat down, and when the baton came down, on those opening chords. It was like hearing that cheap little Spanish synthesizer that I got suddenly becoming into this massive three-dimensional stereo. You know, it was like, it was huge and it was beautiful.
Yeah. And that was just a rehearsal then. So when you had finally the actual concert in some really nice concert hall and everybody's all dressed up and it was a packed hall, that was almost like the climax of your book, you know, towards the end of the book where you described that. It would be nice if there had been a video of that.
No, there wasn't a video of it, but there's a recording of it. So, yeah, so that's what I got.
So just as a reminder for people listening, I'm going to play one of the movements of the symphony at the end of this video and show a bunch of pictures. Anything more you want to say about the concert, or you want to, should we move on to some other points?
Yeah, the concert itself, I'd started to realize there was a lot of synchronicity was happening in my life, you know, like the people at the yoga center and then meeting the cellist. And not only that, I mean, the reason the concert sold out basically was because the orchestra said, oh, would you mind saying a few words to the local press about your piece? I said, yeah, sure. So I did do. And then the Cambridge Evening News said, hey, you're the guy who went under the train, aren't you? And I said, yeah, because it was covered a lot, you know, in Cambridge. And they said, oh, this is going on the front page. I was going, fantastic. And then after that, more people phoning me up, and then the BBC got in touch and they said that they'd like to come down and do a small feature on the news. They did. So there's a short clip from that somewhere, but it wasn't the whole thing, unfortunately. So that was great, and that meant that it sold out 2 weeks in advance, and there was no sense of ego about this. It wasn't like, hey, great, big sellout concert. I was just thinking, great, there's going to be more people coming along and experiencing hopefully what I went through themselves and stuff. And there were so many people coming up just before the concert and after saying they'd had similar experiences, all these different things. There were a lot of people coming forward who wanted to share what the emotion was. And the whole atmosphere that night was just like beautiful. When the orchestra did play, I mean, I remember I was sat with my family. We were given the front row and we were all sat there, and I enjoyed listen to it. I wasn't nervous. I just sat back and actually enjoyed my symphony in full for the first time, you know, as if I was a punter in the audience. And then right at the end, there was a tremendous applause, and my mum was in tears again, but this time there were tears of joy, and she was hugging me. And she said, David, that was just so beautiful. They never heard it. And I said, thanks, Mum. And then my sister said, David, look, behind you. I said, what? And I looked, and there was like a standing ovation. So I thought, this is incredible. So again, the atmosphere, the energy was just so tremendous that I just thought I could not fault this. I couldn't swap it. It was just really beautiful.
That kind of reminds me of Beethoven's Ninth. He was deaf by the time he composed that. And when it was performed, he was in the front row and he obviously couldn't hear his own composition. And then somebody had to turn him around to show him at the end that the audience was going wild.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, obviously, I wasn't expecting that. You know, I didn't know about standing ovations. I didn't even know that that would happen, and I didn't realize it would. And so it was just great. It just meant, yes, everyone got it. Everyone was like transposed. I was hopefully for however long that it was being performed for and stuff. So yeah, so I was hoping that people got to, you know, naturally taking away with it also. Yeah.
So that's really cool. And so that was what, 15, 18 years ago that?
Yeah, 2008, performed? That was, yeah. So that
2008,
that was,
yes. Yeah. So
and then from then on, from that one onwards, I got sort of like, you know, people would come forward. I got commissioned straight away to do another piece. And then one of the clarinet members in that orchestra turned around and said, look, you know, I'm part of this group called the Cambridge Clarinet Choir. We'd like to also commission you to write a piece for us. I said, yeah, great. Again, that was all new to me. I went along to meet them all. And I said, well, you know, tell me more about your clarinets and stuff like that. And they said, well, yeah, I just thought there was one clarinet and that's it. They said, no, there's about six different sizes, you know. And so, you know, there's a bass clarinet, which is like about 6 foot in length, you know. It's just like when they got the guy to blow one note on it, and it was just like a, you know, ship coming into harbor. It was just like, wow, you know. So I went away, and just that was a whole new sketch pad, if you like, a whole new sort of canvas for me to work with. And
they wanted me to write something as well that was, they said, we heard that you wrote something really beautiful about your near-death experience. We'd like you to do something similar for us. I said, great, yeah, I'd love to. So that was another piece called
Awake.
So have
you been able to support yourself financially through this music and painting?
Yeah. I mean, it's just, the book's been really good, actually. That's been great, you know, but yes, I have, you know, especially, you know, the commissions from the music are really good when they come in, but obviously, you know, they're not like coming in every other month or what have you. Whereas with the artwork, that's more. Yes, I guess.
So you create paintings and actually sell them to people and they keep them. And...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'll get commissions and stuff like that. So, I'll do stuff. I do a lot of work I got commissioned by a spiritualist church recently to do a painting for them. And, which is now hanging on in the wall in their church. And that was great. That was a lovely one to do because it was a nice big painting that really owned up the wall and, yeah, that was special to me because it meant that it was something that I felt I could give back, you know, as well as being commissioned for it. So that was good. But not all my work is based around spirituality. There's also, you know, I'll get other work that comes in as well, you know, maybe even portraits and stuff like that, which is completely different, which is fine, you know.
Yeah. Do you feel, do you still feel the flow of inspiration? Related to your near-death experience, like it opened up some portal and you keep getting creative juices flowing from that experience?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. You know, I'm just, you know, cause I work a lot. Even if I'm not working on any commissions, I work, that's when I'm doing a lot of work based on my spirituals. So I'm working on one at the moment, which is literally all about trusting in the energy of the universe, you know, because I'm starting to realize just how much going back to animals, you know, that we've lost that as well. We've lost that, you know, that kind of common connection with the universal pool, you know. When I started to realize that, I'd look out my window, I'd see birds migrating every year. And I used to think to myself, well, how come they fly off to the other side of the world and they come back? And I started to notice that they were the same birds that would come back a year later and they would land on exactly the same spot on a meadow outside my window. And I think, well, they traveled like, you know, thousands of miles, but they still managed to come back to this particular point. And it's incredible that, you know, the universe is telling them what to do. The universe is telling them when it's time to migrate and what have you. And I just, my latest painting that I'm working on now is all about trusting in the energy of the universe.
Nice. Do you ever have dry spells the way writers have writer's block?
Oh yeah. I mean, yeah, that happens. You know, I mean, there's times when something's just not coming together, you know, or I start on it and I come back and think, no, this one's not working. So I just tend to not get frustrated. I just park it, you know, just put it to one side and then come back to it. And then it's almost like I can come back as if I haven't actually started creating it myself. You know, I'm coming back as if to say, you know what you're doing wrong there. This is all the perspective's wrong. That guy shouldn't be over there. It's like, ah, okay, that's why it's done. So, you know, I'm better at being more objective, you know, once I take a break from one particular thing. Yeah.
Did your NDE inspire you to start some kind of regular spiritual practice, some meditation or something like that?
Yeah.
Aside from, art can be a spiritual practice, but, you know, traditional spiritual practice of some sort.
Well, spiritual healing is something that I kept up and
healing
still
others or being healed.
No, being healed. Yeah. I see. Because, I just, I'm not sure. Yeah. I did have some, I actually had a few lessons on giving spiritual healing and I haven't taken that any further because you know, it's taken very seriously and you have to have papers and qualifications to be able to start healing people, which is good, you know. But I tend to, for me, going for spiritual healing is not just going to be healed, you know, physically and emotionally. It's my
It's the nearest thing I would say that to coming to that realm is going into spiritual healing, because the actual energy in that room, in that space, is just so beautiful, you know, that it's like, it's really incredible. And just the connection between, you know, I'd always turn around to the healers and say, oh, you're a brilliant healer, thank you so much. And every one of them would say, no, I'm not a brilliant healer, you know, but, you know, the healing's coming through me. They pretty much say, look, I'm just conducting the energy through and stuff. So, but then I started to realize that it's almost like a circular motion as well, that, you know, we're kind of all, because we'd always chat for a few moments afterwards and stuff. And so I started to realize that there's an energy that's coming through them that they're conducting, but whatever that is, it's also they're feeling something from themselves as well. So yes, yeah, so spiritual healing is like something that is probably the only thing that I can think of that I really take part in. But meditation, yeah, when I'm at home, yeah, I meditate a lot. That's really good.
And have you ever had any more kind of what we might call flashy experiences, like your near-death experience was, where you sort of really get out there and there's some profound cognition or unbounded awareness or tremendous bliss or anything like that?
Yeah, I guess it's strange, you know, because I feel like it's never really gone away. I mean, I've never really had moments where it's kind of like where I start to sort of, I'm kind of blessed. I guess it's because I'm creating, still, you know, with my art and my music, that enables me to still explore things. You know, if I'd had to go back to, say, you know, a regular 9-to-5 job, then I guess there's a part of me probably would find it hard just to keep going back and exploring it. But because of the fact that it's there all the time, I don't know, it seems to have stayed with me. You know, and obviously there are moments where I feel there are spiritual moments that I feel stronger than others. But to me, it's all about the way I look at my experiences. It was complete compared to how my life was before, as I pointed out. You know, it was a spiritual awakening, and I think a spiritual awakening you don't reach a point of spiritual awakening. It continues. You know what I mean? It's not like a point where you say, you know, I'm going to keep. Working and working at this until I become spiritually enlightened, and then I'll be okay. That's not the way to look at it. So I just keep sort of practicing, just believing in it and have your faith. Yeah.
I have a similar attitude. I've said that a million times on this show, that there is no such a thing as a final resting place, that beyond which there could be no further growth, that, which is kind of, makes, I kind of don't like the word enlightenment because it implies finality, you know? But we all keep growing. And so that's what I've gathered, that, you know, this NDE you had was just a kickstart. And since then, the motor keeps running, and you keep evolving, keep growing in various dimensions and ways.
Exactly. That's it. I just feel that it's important just for all of us to never stop learning. You know, the more you open yourself up to learning, you know, the more things will come to you. You know, all these different things will naturally come if you open yourself up and you ask for those things. As long as they're coming from the right place, that is. You know what I mean? Then I think that's like, I mean, I know that manifestation has been a big word over the past few years that a lot of people have talked about, and people are looking for, you know, manifestation. And I do actually believe in manifestation. I think this is probably what I'm trying to say, you know, that I think if you're coming from the right place, then manifestation will start to evolve. If you're turning around saying, no, you know, I just want to get out there and get the fastest car and get and all these different things, then it's not necessarily going to work. You know? So, yeah. So it's just, it's presence as well. Just because the one thing I remember, the big takeaway from that NDE was that I realized when I was in that space that, as I say, there was no sense of time. I remember noticing that. And I remember thinking to myself at that point that I'd spent the whole of my life either thinking about the past mistakes or past opportunities, or thinking about the future, thinking where's my life going to go? You know, what am I going to do? It's such a mess. And I never, ever thought about the present moment, you know. Whereas when I was in that realm, the present moment was the only thing that existed, you know, just that. And that is so important. And that's something that I'm starting to discover, that there's more and more people are starting to talk about that as well, talking about the present moment, which is great because I think it's important, you know.
Sure. I mean, that's Eckhart Tolle's big theme, right? The power of now.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, I came across him recently. He's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I still haven't managed to snag him for an interview. Maybe one of these days. Is there anything else that, you know, comes to mind that we haven't talked about that you want to get out there before we conclude?
We covered a lot, haven't we? So I'm sure.
Oh, on the manifestation point, there was one thing I just remembered, which is that one spiritual teacher always, with regard to manifestation, always used to say, deserve, then desire. You know, not just I want the sports car, but deserve, you know, increase your deserving ability. And if you do that, you might find that the sports car is not what you really want. You know, there might be something more meaningful than that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I totally agree with you. You know, that's it. You know, I find that, you know, just an item of clothing, you know. It's just kind of like there are times when you think, oh, I'd love to go out and get myself a really nice expensive suit or what have you. And I know me, when I've done that, I get that expensive suit and then it's just kind of stays hung in the wardrobe for special occasions and stuff like that. And then I tend to enjoy wearing the beaten old cheap clothes and stuff that I've been painting and decorating in. And I think, actually, I really prefer these clothes. You know, they're me. They're kind of like, they're more sort of like the authentic, true me, you know. And so that's the other thing that I think is really important to focus on, is looking for things that reflect your authentic, true self, you know. That I had no idea that I could have developed, you know, myself with my, there you go. Yeah. That's a good thing for me to be able to talk about. Cause as I pointed out at the beginning of the interview, was that when I was at school, the way I was written off was so badly, you know, that as a no hoper. And it's good to try and sort of like make sure that you let go of some of those, the blueprint, if you like, that's been stamped on you by adults, teachers or what have you, who really haven't got that much time to spend to be able to really focus on you. But it hurts, you know, and it stays. So it's just kind of letting go of that and finding, you know, a bit of self-love is the start, and then some self-worth will follow. And when you find that self-worth, that's when you start to realize your true authentic self, you know, that can come through. Like I did with my music and art, that wouldn't have happened otherwise. If I'd never had that NDE, I would not have gone down that road of exploring music and art at all, you know. So it's just, it doesn't have to be music or art. It doesn't have to be creative. You know, you might just turn around. I mean, the pandemic was a fine example of that, wasn't it? You know, when that happened at first, I actually thought this has felt like a huge awakening, a spiritual awakening for the world, because people were turning around, putting stuff up on social media saying, hey, it's great not going into work. I'm walking down the street with my kids and we're listening to the bird song and we're looking at trees. And I thought, wow, this is it. This is what we need. I know there was obviously the downside of the whole pandemic, but that didn't last. Then suddenly people were saying, I'm getting sick and tired of this. I need to get back to work. I mean, when are we getting back to normality? And I thought, no, don't blow this beautiful opportunity. You know, enjoy the moment, enjoy this freedom of not aspiring, you know.
Yeah, it was definitely a bit of a reset. In fact, there for a long time, I think they're starting to, companies are starting to clamp down again, but for a long time there was just all this empty office space, and it was a real problem for the owners of the buildings because nobody wanted to work in the office anymore. They all wanted to work at home, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another thought that popped up based upon the things you've been saying is, you know, you're saying I mean, people listen to these stories about NDEs and they think, well, I'd love to have that kind of experience, but I don't particularly want to get dragged under a train or, you know, have cancer or get shot or, you know, all these ways in which people have NDEs. But, you know, as Jesus said, seek and ye shall find, knock and the door shall be opened. So without having to go through anything traumatic or life-threatening, you can just, you know, begin to stir up your desire for this, knowing that there is something more, and take some action steps, you know, some practice, some reading, something which attracts you. And one thing leads to the next, you know, the you do begin to find and the door begins to open.
Absolutely. That's how I see it. Then synchronicity starts to happen as well. You know, for all of us, that's then suddenly, you know, things, that's because it's meant to happen. You know, somebody will suddenly come across your pathway. It's like saying, hey, you know, I could help you out with this. It's like, great. You know, then it will start to come together. You know, yeah. I was speaking to a friend of mine who was a singer and songwriter in a band, and, he was just talking about, you know, the fact that, you know, he was like, he said when he started off, they wanted to make money because, like myself, you know, they thought there's no other way of doing it. But he said that they just focused so hard on just the music, rather than thinking, well, they weren't thinking about, you know, getting a record deal or getting, you know, selling lots of records. They just wanted to focus on the music itself. And he said that we found that once we focused on that music, that the songs started to come together, then suddenly the record companies were knocking on their door saying, hey, you know, we want to offer you a deal and stuff. And so that's how it works. I really believe that. So yeah.
Yeah. Good. All right. Well, thanks, David. So, what we're going to do next in a minute is, we're going to play your symphony or part of your symphony and show a bunch of pictures on the screen while that plays. So people should stay tuned for that.
Yeah.
And you do have a website. I'll be linking to that from your page on batgap.com. Other than that, I don't think you're out there as a spiritual teacher giving talks and all that business, although I imagine you'd be open to it if somebody wanted you to come give a talk.
Yeah. I've done some talks, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So people could invite you to do that.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you don't do individual consultations with people, I don't imagine.
I don't do individual consultations, no. I mean, I've just done stuff, you know, where I've been invited to go along to different, they're normally sort of like summits and things like that, you know, where they're not other people who've had NDEs. They're more people who are end of life doulas and stuff like that. I've done a few with them, you know, where I've gone out and we've talked about dealing with death. And so, you know, my story kind of has been really, really useful from that point of view. Yeah.
It's very useful. And like we said earlier, you know, that saying, life sucks, then you die. That's popular over here. I don't know about over there. I have a variation on that I came up with, which is that life may or may not suck, and then you appear to die, but you really don't.
Some people are already walking dead, aren't they? Just by not living life, not really giving themselves an option to move on from it.
But, so live life and live long and prosper.
That's Star Trek. You know. There's loads of French films that used to come out. They've got great titles. And I saw one, or actually, I think it might have been a German film, and it was on TV recently, and it was called Fear Eats the Soul. And I thought, yeah, that's great. That's a great title. Do you know what I mean?
Fear Eats the Soul.
Fear Eats the Soul. And that's what a lot of people tend to get themselves into.
Yeah, some say that mindset. Fear is an acronym for false evidence appearing real.
Oh, wow. That's great.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. And thanks to you, David. Now let's listen to that music and see some nice photos of paintings. See you for the next one.
Thank you.